So we'll begin tonight with a short well, it's called loving kindness meditation. But that bothers me. The problem with things like doing loving kindness meditation is that we think we're practicing loving kindness if we do loving kindness meditation. And we can feel pretty good about that. The practice of loving kindness is a practice we need to do with people. That's the practice of loving kindness. So when we come together like tonight, where we practice loving kindness meditation, it's just so that we can learn that attitude of the heart. We can learn to generate friendship and all the qualities of friendship toward all beings. So again, please don't think just because we do it here that that's the practice. The practice goes on in our daily life, in our relationships. And in the same way we practice mindfulness here, but again, we're just doing it so we can develop the capacity to live a mindful life. So I just wanted to make that clear. So Angie will lead us in a short practice session on loving kindness. So welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. And again, for those in the back, if my voice goes down, you can't hear it, just kind of encourage me. Or move forward. Either way. So before we return to our text, The Great Path of Awakening, we always begin by, if anyone has any questions about practice, the formal practices that we do here, practice in general, meditation practice, mindfulness practice in general, or anything specifically related to how one brings the Dharma into one's life and the challenges that may arise in doing that skillfully. So if anyone has any questions, we'll just take a few moments. Yes, Dave. So the question is, what is beginner's mind, and how does one cultivate that as a practice? Beginner's mind is a wonderful concept, which it's funny. Thich Nhat Hanh, he often talks about having a fresh mind, which is really it's the same thing. So the idea of a beginner's mind is we know when we are a beginner at anything, what? We don't know anything, right? So we are very open, and we're very fresh because we don't have any concepts about how things should be because we don't have any history. And we, when we're beginners, we're kind of, it's like honeymoon. You know, we want to learn. We want to enjoy ourselves. We're happy, right? Something new, something fresh has come into our life. And so I think we all, in many ways, many aspects of our lives, know that whether it's the beginning of a vacation or a relationship or a career or a day or, you know what I mean, et cetera, often that beginning is very pure and fresh. But if we talk about a day, we may find that at the end of the day we are not quite in the same mind state as we were in the... you know, or you may begin a new job or something. And, you know, in the beginning, it's really exciting, new people, new challenges, new ideas. And, you know, 3 months later, it's beginning to be a little old. Right. Well, what's happened? Same job, but we've changed, right? Because we have now overlaid that freshness and immediacy of spontaneous experience which we were open to in the beginning, now we've overlaid it with lots of experience and history and concepts and about this and that and me and you and what it is and what it isn't, you know what I'm saying? And that is, we don't realize now we have taken this fresh, pure experience and we've overlaid it. Right? And so we are no longer experiencing the freshness of the experience, we're experiencing the overlay that we're projecting onto it. And obviously, that is robbing us of the capacity to be to really be alive with this fresh beginner's mind to what we're experiencing. Another way to think about this fresh beginner's mind, we could call it a child's mind. Right? And since we know that all of us, even though we may look at each other and we appear as adults, we all began as children, right? There is nobody here who came out this way or has always been this way. We've all been children. And so we've all had that mind. You know, children have this incredible capacity to what? To be happy and to be involved. And to just light up their eyes when they see something, right, that interests them. And they have incredible curiosity about little things, right? Beginner's mind. So we have beginner's mind when we start out in life. So cultivating that freshness means to let go of all one's concepts, all one history, right? Oh, you know, I've done this so many times. I've seen this movie before. I've heard this song before. You know, I've gone to work. You know what I mean? I know what's going to happen. Right? That's all. And then we wonder why it's always now the same. Right? And why we get bored. It's really not the same. It's never the same, because every moment is fresh, right? Like this moment right now, none of us have ever been at, right? Has anybody ever been in this moment before? We laugh because we know, of course not. This is a fresh moment. Well, how do you have your mind be in this moment so you can touch the freshness? It's to have an empty mind. A mind that's not full of concepts and judgments and, you know, etc. How do we learn how to have this mind? Through the practice of mindfulness, through the practice of concentration, through the practice of reminding ourselves of the freshness of this moment. So when we get up in the morning and there's that little gata, today is a brand new day, I have 24 new hours. You know, let me live it fully, let me live it mindfully. We have never passed this way before. And that's the truth. These aren't, religious syllogisms or, you know, affirmations. This is the truth. Right? But you have to take off this encapsulation of the mind and experience in this overly produced, overly reified over time sense that I know everything. I know what today's going to be. I know how David's going to be tonight. I know what David's going to say. You know what I mean? If we're like that, we can see how there's separation. And there's this, you know, the child doesn't know anything. That's why it's fresh. The beginner doesn't know anything. So they're open to everything. It's a learner's mind. Now, this is a wonderful stance for life, but in more specifically in relationship to our practice, every time we sit down on the cushion is a brand new time, right? It's brand new. We have never sat on this cushion at this time ever, and we have never been present to our mind with what's going to be arising in it today ever. It's always new. Even the old stories can be new. But if you sit down on the cushion with expectations of how it's supposed to be, When things arise, you already label it, label it in the sense that you kind of put your own projection on what it's about and where it's going and how it should be and how it shouldn't be, and I don't want it to be, it should be different. That's not beginner's mind. That's a mind that thinks it knows everything. And you know what? That's an old mind. You know, it's an interesting thing. Bodies are clearly age. That's readily observable, right? But the mind, awareness, does not age, right? This moment is as fresh to a 2-year-old as it is to a 20-year-old, as it is to a 40 or a 60 or an 80-year-old, if the mind is pure and fresh and open. Right? But when you see people who have old minds, who have aging minds, it's because their minds have gotten rigid. Their minds have gotten, they just live. I believe this, and I know this, and I only do this, and I see things. You know, everything is seen through thought, through conceptualization, and that's an old mind. So people age in their minds because they've lost that aliveness. So a lot of people, they die by the time they're 20 or 30 or 40. Right? And then they kind of just live it out. And you wonder why there's no aliveness in them, why there's no spontaneity, why there's no naturalness. Right? It's because they, you know, it's like they've learned a script, you know, by the time they're 25, and then they just keep repeating it for 40 or 50 more years. Right? Kind of sad, isn't it? So, fresh mind, beginner's mind, it's good. And in terms of this practice, it's good. Every day is a new day. Right? Every day is an opportunity. No matter how the last round of sitting went, how the last day went... It doesn't matter, does it? It's gone. Why drag, you know, why drag what's already gone into the present? All that does is what? Contaminates it. When you go home tonight, walk into your house with fresh eyes. The eyes are always fresh. Right? Do eyes think? No, eyes just look. Do ears think? No, they just hear. Right? So when you look and hear, when you go home tonight, whether it's your home, the things in your home, the people in your home, see them as if you've never seen them before. Because in truth, you can remember seeing them before, right? But your remembering of seeing them before is a memory, isn't it? It's not what's happening now. What's happening now is alive. My memory of what happened before is not alive. It's just mental. So beginner's mind, fresh mind, good. Good stuff. Something worth cultivating. You know, and beginner's mind is fearless. That's another good quality. You know, we get very, along the way, we get worries and anxieties and fears. And it's another thing that weighs us down. Huh? It's funny about little children. And it's a scary thing for parents. They're kind of fearless, don't they? They just go for it. They have that wonderful energy. They don't care what people think about what they're doing. They don't care if they look like an idiot or not. Right? They don't care if they succeed or fail. They don't think this way, do they? They just enter. So, you know, in Zen, living in one's natural mind, living a natural life, is very much the way we're encouraged to live, not to live in artifice, not to live artificially, but to live a natural life. One has to be able to touch and trust and live from one's own nature. The practice of mindfulness, the practice of meditation, allows us to break out of our conditioning so we can reconnect with our true self and begin to experience the naturalness of being who we are, and to trust that. But many people, they're always living from here, right? They're thinking their way through life. That's not natural. That's artificial. Because what they're thinking is about all their, all kind of concepts and learnings and ways of doing things and how things should be or ought to be or the way you were taught. So we're always living, there's a filter through which our capacity to live freely and naturally is getting twisted. And so we aren't at ease with being who we are and living a natural, simple life. You know, animals don't have these problems. Right? Again, not to say that we are the same as animals. We are blessed with certain gifts that animals don't have. But yet that does not deny that in the capacity of animals to be at one with their nature and to kind of be who they are is something wonderful. I think that's why we enjoy being around animals, having pets. They are who they are. That's why I think we enjoy being around little children. They're very refreshing. Especially if you've been spending a lot of time hanging around adults. You know, you can find hanging around children a great joy. Or hanging around animals, pets, a great joy. But again, all of us have that capacity to return home and to recover our beginner's mind. And to recover our capacity to be fresh. We don't need to age before our time. Maybe we can talk about this some other time. but there's an interesting point you raise, which is, I don't know if everybody heard, Helena's sharing a difficulty she has in her studies, in a program she's in, where she has to use an aspect of her mind that is sort of her weakness, and therefore finds it difficult, and therefore finds that she kind of thinks about it in ways and talks about it in a way that just kind of reifies the weakness and the difficulty, and she'd like to get out of it. And she was wondering, can't meditation get me out of it? My answer was, I don't know, I guess I would say. It's interesting because, I mean, traditionally in Buddhism, meditation is not used that way. Okay. Now, you know, meditation is traditionally used to develop mindfulness. Meditation is used to develop concentration, clarity of mind, you know, integration, wholeness of mind, etc. And then once that capacity of mind training, then to look deeply into it. So if you're saying Can I, in once my mind is still and open, can I begin to look into the source of my weakness? I would say, of course. But having said that, that doesn't mean, that you still won't have a weakness. we're all different, right? And having said we're all different, doesn't mean that parts of within us that are weak cannot be strengthened. But can they be strengthened to the point where they're equal to people who have a natural capacity in there? Maybe not. I think one of the interesting things, I'm going a little side here, is acceptance. I think a wonderful thing for each of us is to come to a place where we accept who we are. Now that sounds easy, but what that means is, can I accept that other people have more capacities than I do in certain areas? Other people are richer than me. Other people are more handsome than me. Other people are better athletes than me. Other people have all kinds of things, right, than me. So what? Right? So what? And to come to that place where there is no shame, there is no sense of deficiency, that the way we look at our so-called weaknesses as just, yeah, of course, that's fine. Because at the same time, I know who I am, I know my capacities, that I know where I am comfortable and where I do feel like that's the kind of person I am. And because I've undertaken this program, I have to, challenge myself in areas that, if I was in charge of my life, I never would. Right? And that's just the truth. But because I want this to move in this path, I'm going to have to somehow, hopefully, develop enough skill that I can at least pass the courses, pass the boards, or whatever. Right? So at that point, it becomes less a sense of personality. Something in myself I need to fix. Saying that that's not the case, that this is just a clear deficiency of the mind. Deficiency meaning, that in this area, either because of my proclivities or my capacities, I just don't, right? And so all I need to do is develop enough skill or whatever, competency in this area, so I can get by. But it is no way a reflection on me. It's not personal. It's not a personal deficiency. I am not less than. There's nothing wrong with me. Because that's where we go. You see? And it's a wonderful thing to be objective about oneself. The trouble is we identify with ourself as if we're something real. As if ourself is something real. As opposed to what? Just a bunch of characteristics. Some are like this, some are like that. One can look into one's history, one can look into one's family, one can look into one's genetic pool, one can look into one's upbringing, and, come to a good understanding. But the bottom line is, so what? Right? And so what? It's a struggle for you. So what? When you know who you are, you'll just do what you need to do. And again, if developing some new skills or competencies, will make it easier for you, good. If there are kind of certain ingrained anxieties and fears or conceptions or projections that you bring to that area when you move into that area of your mind or activity that sabotage you, yeah, you can look deeply into them so you can free yourself of them. Right? But always do that from a place of acceptance. It's not about me. It's not about somebody called Helena. And to have that objectivity, that detachment from the drama of self. Right? It's because we so identify ourself with the drama of self and its successes and failures. Right? Right? It's, you know, that all that emotionality arise. As you know, looking deeply into the self-identity, no self can be found. But when we attach an Helena to that activity, and her worth or lack of worth, her goodness or badness, or, you know, gets caught up in that, then there's a lot of emotionality. Then there's a lot of drama. Right? It doesn't mean we still aren't challenged, but the emotionality isn't there. There's no story attached to the activity. You just do your best. Right? And like you say, the whining, the talking about, you can let go of that because you accept that this is the way it is. Right, and this is something I have to deal with, and a year or two from now it'll all be behind me, right? And you know, can I just? I think for a lot of us, it's hard for us to enjoy things, especially some things that are hard for us, or difficult for us, or a challenge for us. Again, the thing about children is, even when something's a little new for them or hard for them, they kind of throw themselves into it, you know, and they're, right? And even if it keeps falling down, they build it back up again. And it's good to have some play, not take it so seriously. I mean, there are probably more important things to take more seriously, like your happiness and well-being. That's something to take seriously. So let me return to the Great Path of Awakening. Remember, this is this teaching that has these very pithy slogans. And the last time I was here, we did... We did, when evil fills the world and its inhabitants, change adverse conditions into the path of awakening. And then we did, be grateful to everyone. Is that right? Does that sound right? Okay. Did I do drive all blame into one? Okay, so we did those three. They're wonderful. So let's do some others tonight. This is a nice one. All Dharma has a single purpose. So all Dharma, which really means all the teachings, all the practices of Buddhism, that's Dharma, right? Has a single purpose. Anybody have an idea what that one purpose could be? So many different teachings, so many different practices, endless, endless. What could that one purpose be? What?
To release.
No, but that's a good answer. but close. It is about that. All Dharma has one purpose.
Keep us on the path.
Close. All of those. What?
Reduce
self-centeredness. Right. Now, isn't that interesting? Now, of course, it ties into everything that you brought up. On Wednesday night, once a month, we have the St. Pete Sangha in St. Pete over to our house for practice. And Steve was there. And there was a very intense young man who comes regularly last 3 or 4 months. And he asked a question, you could tell he was very, very frustrated with his meditation, right? That he sits and he still, his mind is just full of thoughts and he keeps getting caught up in thoughts, and you could tell he was frustrated, feeling pretty bad. And so he kind of asked me, you know, what can he do? So after acknowledging that it's probably true that he is a lousy meditator, and that's probably, he's probably giving an accurate description of his practice, I then said to him, Luis, you know, the purpose of practice is not to be a good meditator. The purpose of practice is to become a good human being. And we often forget that. Seems kind of obvious, right? Because we get caught up in the meditation and it becomes, again, a task, something we're succeeding or failing in, something we're good and good or bad in, something we're giving ourselves an A or a B or a C or a D or an F, right? We continue to think that that's what this is about, you know. But this is not what it's about. Meditation is just one aspect. Concentration is just one aspect of a path that is only about healing and transformation, so we can become a good person, somebody who lives in awareness, somebody who wants to alleviate the suffering of beings. Right? And you know what? The interesting thing, if there's anybody else in here who thinks they're a lousy meditator, being a lousy meditator is a wonderful thing. I highly recommend it to people. That doesn't mean try to be a lousy meditator. Let it happen naturally. Right? I mean, in other words, this is not something to make an effort at. This is something that will happen by itself. Now, I'm saying that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but I'm also quite serious. Obviously, the meditative path is very central within the Buddhist Eightfold Path. Because learning to live in mindfulness, learning to concentrate the energies of the mind, learning to develop some capacity of a stable, calm mind that has some degree of training, that it's kind of somewhat goes where we want it to go and does what we want it to do, is kind of important. But for what reason? So we can get on with the business of being a good human being, a loving human being, a compassionate human being, an accepting human being, a wise human being, right? All those qualities, that's what this Dharma is about, right? And so it's important. When we think about the purpose of Dharma, the purpose of Dharma is not to be a good meditator. Right? Again, that doesn't mean that you know, one can't develop that skill. Right? But one could still be a very self-centered jerk and have good concentrated qualities in their meditation. Right? Because to be a good meditator and be a, and still be a self-centered SOB is quite possible. Right? to be a good meditator and still be a total narcissist, totally concerned about oneself. Can still happen, can't it? So this is why this statement, all Dharma has one purpose, is very important to us. And something, no matter what Dharma you're practicing, no matter what meditation practice you're doing, no matter what teachings you're interested in, the test of whether they are working in a meaningful way in your life is that you are becoming less egocentric. Egocentric means what? My world centers on myself. All my thoughts are tinged with I and me. In all my experiences and relationships, there's always a self that is watching out for me, advancing me, defending me, getting things for me, right? As long as the me is the center of my life, I will feel alone. I will feel separate. I will feel dissatisfied. I will feel cut off. Because narcissists and people who suffer from egocentricity have a very limited capacity for happiness. They're only happy when what? When things are going their way. They're only happy when their needs are being met. Which doesn't happen all the time, does it? So therefore, if you're self-centered, and if you're focused only on your needs, your wants, your fulfillment, you will find yourself, much of the time, frustrated. Much of the time, disappointed. Much of the time, unhappy. With yourself and others. Well, narcissists are never dissatisfied with their health. They're always dissatisfied with others. But again, let's say there are 30 people in this room. If I am only 100% concerned with myself, with only my needs and my wants and my happiness, then I am cutting out everyone else. Right? But also, I am also making my happiness dependent on one. Right? But if, let's say, not that I deny this one, but I acknowledge that I am just 1/30th, let's say, of this group. And therefore, seeking 1/30th of the happiness is really all I'm entitled to. But on the other hand, if my objective, my intention, is to secure the happiness of all 30, it's very different than only securing the happiness of the one. And it feels different. It also means, right, that when Susan is happy, when Susan tells me about good things that are going on in her life, I can be what? Happy. Right? Now I can take happiness from all 30 people. Right? I can care about the success of all 30 people. I can want to eliminate and alleviate the suffering of unhappiness of everybody here. Right? I'm now connected. Right? And happiness or unhappiness is not dependent solely on me. But most of us, unfortunately, live in a drama of which self is all important. And everybody else in our life, except maybe a few, are just minor characters. And then we wonder, why is there so much drama in my life? Why is there so much emotionality in my life? Why is there so much up and down in my life? Because the self is involved in everything. If you take the self out of the equation, what happens? Anybody ever try to take the self out of their drama? Even just for an hour or two? Has anybody ever tried taking the self out of their drama? Anybody having drama right now with anybody? Anybody having a little drama? Family, friends, oneself, one's past, dead people, alive people. You know. I mean, Robbie.
I know.
All right. Take the self out. Take Gary out of it. What happens? Take your story, take your drama, and give it to somebody else. Now somebody else is telling you the story of what's going on. Do you still have the same intensity of emotion? No, it immediately goes. Why? Nothing's changed. Except we're no longer living the life, the relationship, the situation, only through this person's eyes. Right? Let's say you're in a drama with one other person, right? The drama of disappointment, the drama of hurt, the drama of fear, the drama of anger, resentment, the drama, you know, et cetera, right? I would imagine if you're deep in it, it's all about me, right? Well, if you just were willing to only take 50% of it and step outside and go into the other person and go, how is the other person seeing it? What does the situation look through their eyes? What are they feeling? You'll immediately cut it by 50%. Right? The more you can let go of self, the happier you will be. Now, this is the exact opposite of what most people ensnared in egocentricity believe the opposite.
Right.
We believe what? As long as I uphold the I, protect the I, advance the I, always concerned about the I's reputation, how it's perceived, how it's doing, how it's succeeding, how it's liked, you know what I mean? Always getting its needs met, right? Our belief is what? If we get it going 100%, then we'll be what? Happy. Right? Isn't that the belief? Then I'll be happy. But it doesn't work. Because we are not the center of the world. Right? Like even in this room, each of us is only 1/30th of this. Right? To acknowledge that and to live it is a great freedom. A great burden is lifted psychologically, emotionally. You can let go. This is the Bodhisattva way. But to do this way, the practices of meditation, the practices of insight, the practices of loving kindness, the practices of compassion, the practice of awareness, all these things, the practice of non-self. All these teachings and practices help us understand it so we can live it. But all Dharma has one purpose, the lessening of self. What is a Buddha? A Buddha is a selfless being. Still here. Still eating and drinking. Still going to the bathroom. Still going to sleep at night. Right? But a Buddha is only concerned about what? The well-being of everyone else. And this is not codependency. This is not, some kind of pathological ego deformation. This is freedom. And it's not, it's not helping from ego. When ego helps, it's always watching. It's always praising. It's always wanting to be noticed. It's always trying to get something. Right? That's when ego helps. But when there's no ego, it's just free, open, spontaneous, natural, seeks nothing in return. Every day the sun rises. What a blessing. We couldn't live here on earth without the sun. Right? Has the sun ever asked us for anything back? Right? After all I've done for you guys on earth, now it's my turn. The sun never says that to us, does it? The sun just rises. It gives its light and heat. Could it be that simple? Could our hearts be that open? Could our hearts and minds be that free? That empty of egocentricity? That empty of personal drama? Right? That we could be like that? Go through life kind, helpful, open, understanding, doing our best to bring goodness and happiness to ourselves and everyone else. Any questions or challenges? I'm always looking for people to stand up for egocentricity. Anybody want to stand up for narcissism? Any? But I'm serious. These kinds of teachings, these pith teachings, go right to the heart of things. All Dharma has one purpose, right? You go around, you go to bookstores, you go on Amazon. You go around to different Buddhist groups, you'll hear endless different Buddhist teachings, endless different Buddhist practices, right? One purpose. Some people go around, well, I've taken this teaching and that teaching, and I've been to this teacher, and I practice this meditation, then I practice that meditation. You know what my response to that? So what? So what? What kind of person are you? Are you proud of all the Dharma teaching you've taken? Are you proud of all the meditation you practice? You haven't learned anything. Right? All Dharma has one purpose. To lower the mast of ego. So we can be free of that contamination that limits and narrows and causes so much unnecessary drama, unnecessary suffering in our lives. Any comments, questions about this teaching? All Dharma has one purpose. Are you going to stand up for narcissism?
Not probably. it's so narcissistic of me to actually do that. So I want to share a story that has been running through my mind as you've been talking, right? About 3 years ago.
Can everybody hear Gary? Yes, sir.
Can you hear me? Yeah. Thanks. About 3 years ago, I had a just a really great experience that really is so much about this. I got a phone call from a student who made a request of me. And I thought about the request, and it would have been inappropriate for me to say anything to it. So the student sort of got visibly sort of annoyed with me, and she didn't like it, and she tried to sort of maneuver around. She let me know she wasn't happy with me. And so I sort of had this like dip, because I'm not a nice guy, and she didn't like me. And about 2 minutes later, another student came in and made a request that was totally reasonable. I was more than happy to say, sure, no problem. She said, oh, you made my day. You made my whole week. You have no idea what a great guy you are. And I was faced with a dilemma. Who am I? It was just a wonderful moment. Well, which of them are right? And it was just a great gift for me to be able to release all of them. I'm not any of them. It happened like in 2.5 minutes. It was just a wonderful... They had no idea they did this for me. Right. There's a narcissist. But to really get it, that this collection of stories, it's a collection of ideas, projections, I'm not any person. Yeah. It was just a wonderful moment of freedom and release. That's been with me for years. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great, Gary. I mean, again, and that was, you know, it's those little moments where it's very clear, you go, yes. You know, you see the game of self, right? You know, one minute, one situation, downcast, right? Miserable, unhappy. Next minute, somebody pats you on the back, you know, wonderful, right? Somewhere you go, somebody doesn't say good morning to you, you know. Next person say, "Hey, Gary, how are you? Good to see you." Happy, you know. And if you sit and if you can watch the drama of self as it goes through the day, as it goes through its life, how it goes up and how it goes down, how it feels good and how it feels worthy and how it feels unworthy and how it feels happy and how it feels sad and how it feels relaxed and how it feels, you know. Which is what the practice is, watching the mind, you see it. And you realize what a big baby it is. Isn't it? It's just a big baby, this self of ours. Right? And again, it doesn't have to be, you know, some people, I want to kill my ego, you know. I want to crush it. I want to get rid of it. It's not like that, is it? It's a big baby. Right? And all it needs is to be, right, just taken care of. Right? That's all. Understood. Taken care of. And most importantly, not let it run our life. That's all. Anybody else have... Is somebody in the back or... No.
I was just going to ask a question about this. In relation to those of us who are non-confrontational and we're dealing with people that use non-self or loving kindness as an excuse to let other people run all over us.
Yeah. Good question, Kate. You know what? That reminds me. A couple of weeks ago, I was on a phone call. With a bunch of kind of senior Dharma practitioners, and we were talking about anger, and everybody was saying all the right stuff, you know, about anger. We got to be careful with it. We got to take good care of it. We can't let it. You know, I mean, everybody was doing all the good Dharma stuff, and after about 10-15 minutes, I was like, I had had it. So I said I want to share something. I said, I want to stand up for anger. I feel like anger is getting a bad rap today. And what I tried to say was, yes, anger unbridled, anger attached to strong self, has the capacity of doing damage. So in a certain sense, of the, all the various emotional afflictions, it is one that one should watch. Because without carefulness, careful handling, again, it can do damage. But on the other hand, I truly believe that anger is a human emotion. Right? And it, in a very simple way, it alerts, you know, in the same way when you're enjoying something, you feel happy, right? It just naturally arises, and there's a feeling in the body that lets you know this is good, right? In the same way, anxiety, or the same way, sadness, also is kind of letting us in a more intuitive body way, kind of letting us know at some level there's a response we're having to a situation. Right? I think anger is often also, when it arises in our bodies, is also letting us know that something's going on that we don't feel good about. Right? You know, I mean, it has, can have a lot more specifics, but in that, in a very general sense, there's something about what's going on in this situation that is discomforting to me, right? Okay. And we call that a little anger. Right? Now, at that level, that's good. Now, our response, of our perception of the experience may be correct or incorrect, right? I may be seeing the situation clearly, or I may be seeing the situation very unclearly. So my capacity to acknowledge the anger has arisen in me, right, and to check it out is often worthy, right? Because there may be something in a situation where someone is really out of line, right? I mean, there are times and situations where whole countries, political classes, are out of line, right? And people who are on the receiving end of them are often angry, right? I mean, the slaves were angry with the with slavery. The slaves were angry with slaveholders. Would we say, just practice loving kindness? Have compassion for the slaveholders. Now, in a certain way, we might say, on a personal point of view, that may be an interesting practice. But if we don't allow that anger about injustice or unfairness, right, to arise in us, a very human aspect of what goes on in our interactions will be removed from us. Right? Capacity to act. Right? And then the challenge is having anger awakened me to a situation that I feel is unfair, unjust, wrong, etc., etc., right? See, can I stop with the anger then? Acknowledge it as a feeling. Thank it very much for kind of waking me up and energizing me. And now I move on to what? Skillfulness. Right? Skillfulness of response or non-response. This is where anger gets problematic, because when we are angry, and when we are very angry, it is hard for us to really be skillful. Right? Because anger, you know, anger psychologically and emotionally has lots of manifestations which make that hard to do. So I guess what I'm saying is, I think as practitioners of mindfulness, people who are developing the capacity to be mindful of emotions, to be able to be mindful of anger, is good practice. Not to be scared of it, right? not to be uncomfortable with it. It's just an emotion. Is anybody in here uncomfortable with happiness? No. Why not? We accept it's part of human life. If you lose somebody, something happens that makes you sad. That's humanism. We're all comfortable or want to be comfortable with being sad at times. Our relationship with anger should be the same way. Because sometimes manifesting a little anger towards someone can be beneficial toward them. Right? Some people, like you say, you can be very sweet and nice to, and they just walk all over you, right? And you can, you know, try in many skillful, nice ways to get your point across. But there are a lot of very egocentric people in this world, a lot of very dense people, you know? And sometimes you need to what? You know, in Buddhism, we have these wrathful deities. You know, they're the ones that kind of have fangs and blood's pouring out of their mouths, and they drink from skulls, you know, like the wrathful deities. You know, some people need a wrathful deity because they just walk all over kindness, right? They don't get it. It doesn't stop them from doing harm. So sometimes they manifest anger. You're out of line. That's not right. You can't do that anymore. Now, the less ego, the less Kate, and the more you just kind of see it as a, you know, as a skillful act that you need to play. Because again, oftentimes in this life as of bodhisattvas, one of the things we may have to do is protect beings from harm. Right? So sometimes when you have to protect beings from harm, you may have to be a little wrathful with some of them from doing harm to others. If you saw some adult abusing a child, would you just generate loving kindness to them? Would that be your answer? What would you do? What energizes one to act? So sometimes we have to act to protect. Sometimes we have to act because we realize the condition of this human being is they only understand and respond to some kind of that kind of energy. Right? And if they don't receive that kind of energy, they will continue to create harm. So, I mean, in answer to your question, Kate, yeah, it shouldn't be all, you know, spirituality should not be all, you know, hearts and flowers and incense. You know, sometimes spirituality's got to be a little dirty, a little ragged, a little real. It's important that we remember that. You know, that we don't create some kind of artificial spiritual universe. This kind of Buddhism is called engaged Buddhism, which means it's engaged in life. Has anybody noticed, life is kind of messy, right? It's kind of messy. So if you're going to take your Buddhism, your Dharma, into life, into society, we have to be willing to get a little messy, get a little dirty, sometimes get a little angry. Right? But again, if our motivation is always Compassion, protection of beings, helping beings. This is a very strange story within the Buddhist tradition. You know, the Buddha had all these prior lives, supposedly many, many lives when he was perfecting himself as a bodhisattva. And one of these lives, he was, I don't know who exactly he was. I don't know if he was a monk or something, but he was on a boat and he was up all night meditating. So maybe he was a monk. But he heard these men talking, that their plan was to kill everybody on board. So they could rob them. So their plan was during this night, you know, they were kind of preparing to kill everybody so they could rob them. And supposedly the Buddha overheard in his meditation, overheard the conversation. And wanting to protect the lives of all the innocent people on board, supposedly, I forget if he killed him or threw him overboard or anyhow, did something like that. So it's a very interesting story because that's not the usual kind of story you get, right? And I think it's in there because it shows us sometimes we may even have to do something like even killing someone to protect the well-being of the many, right? I say that only to understand that compassionate action is not simplistic. And why our motivation should always be as pure as it can be, circumstances are always different. Right? So even someone very, very committed to nonviolence may sometimes in extreme situations have to even resort to violence for the greater good. Anyhow, something just to reflect on. So why don't we stop for this night? Please remember, all Dharma has one purpose.